Engage on Studio 809.
What can you do to create a sustainable, just, and carbon-free city? Find out on this episode of Peak Environment. Hear what's next in the closure of the fossil fuel-powered Martin Drake Power Plant in Colorado Springs, and learn about three local climate campaigns on which you can take action. This is audio from a webinar held on February 19, 2021, organized by a group of Colorado College students. It was described as speed dating for climate action. See the show notes for slides and links to organizers, sponsors, and campaigns.
Hello, everyone. My name is Anna McDevitt. I work with the Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, and it's exactly what it sounds like. I work with communities across the state to help them transition off of dirty coal plants to cleaner energy sources like wind, solar, and battery storage. I'm so excited that you were able to join us tonight. Thank you so much for taking the time. I know a lot of us are on Zoom calls all day long these days, and so thanks for adding one more to the mix. But we're excited just to hang out casually tonight and talk about climate action in Colorado Springs. We've got an awesome event planned, and I'm going to kick us off by just starting with a couple things. You know, one, why we're doing this event. I am going to share an overview of what the event will look like, and then I'll kick it off to a couple of our other speakers to get us started here. So a lot of you on this call were probably active in helping to show support to retire the Drake coal plant early. As folks know, or might know, this summer, Colorado Springs Utilities took a bold leadership move to make plans to retire coal in Colorado Springs by the year 2030. So both coal plants, Drake and Nixon, will be retired by that time. And that's a big deal, and we're really excited about it. And a lot of you helped make that happen. So thank you so much for that. But the reality is that's not all we need to do to stave off the very worst impacts of climate change. Once we get to 2030 and Colorado Springs no longer is burning coal, climate change isn't just going to stop, unfortunately. We're going to have more to do. And there's other sectors of our economy that we have to clean up and decarbonize if we're really going to stave off the worst impacts and make sure that our communities are resilient and sustainable when it comes to the environment and the climate. You know, those things include transportation, buildings, public lands, and more. And we're going to talk about some of those things tonight. And so the goal here was to invite all the folks that were so active on the Drake campaign to come back together to talk about what's next for Colorado Springs, to elevate some of the amazing work that is already happening on the ground from some of the amazing organizations that are based in Colorado Springs, and to move forward from there. And so tonight's going to be fun. It's also going to be a lot, but I'm thinking of tonight as kind of like speed dating with other climate campaigns. So you're going to hear from three speakers who have an action that they want you to take tonight. We're going to hear from each speaker for just 8 minutes. We're going to have 5 minutes after they talk to take action. And then at the end of the event, as you can see on this agenda here, we'll have some breakout rooms where you can choose, and actually you can move around the breakout rooms if you want to, but you can choose one of the actions or speakers that you want to join to learn more about their campaign or take some more time to take your action tonight. And there's a little bit of a surprise. We're going to have a raffle at the end of the call, or actually we'll share the link to join the raffle at the end of the call. So if anyone takes two of the three actions tonight, by midnight tonight, you can fill out the form. It'll be on our system. We trust y'all. But we'd love for you to fill out the form with your email address, because we have a $25 gift card to a local coffee shop that we would love to share with the lucky winner who's taken two of the three actions tonight. So that's a little bit about what tonight will look like. And with that, I want to introduce Riley, who's going to do a brief land acknowledgement before we get started.
Hi, everybody. My name is Riley. I use she, her pronouns, and I'm with Beyond Carbon and 350 Colorado Springs. So I just want to welcome any Native folks to this call and invite everybody to acknowledge the land that you're on as we begin this session and important work. So in Colorado Springs, we are on the land of the Ute, Cheyenne, Apache, Comanche, and Arapaho tribes. And tonight we honor with gratitude the land itself and those tribes. It is vital to honor these beginnings and recognize the ongoing dedication and importance of Indigenous culture within our communities and within the land that we gather, live, learn, and work on. It is also important to understand the long-standing history that has brought you to reside on this land and to seek to understand your place within that history. So land acknowledgements do not exist in a past tense or historical context. Colonialism is a current ongoing process, and we need to build our mindfulness of our present participation. So I'm going to pass it to Lindsay.
Hi, everyone. My name is Lindsay Facknitz, and I'm a member of the Beyond Coal, Now Beyond Carbon group here in Colorado Springs. And I just wanted to give a big thank you to all of our sponsors for tonight's event. The organizing groups for tonight's event are Sierra Club's Beyond Coal campaign, which is a national campaign of the Sierra Club, helping communities move from coal and natural gas to clean renewable energy. 350 Colorado Springs, a national grassroots organization working to keep all fossil fuels in the ground and promote just and equitable solutions to the climate crisis. Our co-sponsor, all local chapters or local chapters of national organizations or just simply local organizations that are really doing really excellent work here in Colorado Springs. And you can see more information on all these groups in our chat, but I wanted to verbally acknowledge and give a little summary for the other groups who helped promote this event. The Sierra Club, of course, the largest and most influential environmental organization in the U.S. Colorado Springs Pro Housing Partnership, one of our speaking groups tonight, a local advocacy group working to make housing affordable in Colorado Springs. Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility supports current and former public employees who seek a higher standard of environmental ethics and scientific integrity within their agencies. Southeastern Colorado Renewable Energy Society, leading Southeastern Colorado and its people to an energy efficient and renewable energy economy through education, policy, and economic development. Sunrise, the Colorado Springs chapter. The Sunrise Movement is a youth movement advocating to stop climate change and create millions of good jobs in the process. Peak Alliance for a Sustainable Future is a local volunteer-led nonprofit striving to promote regional sustainability in the Pikes Peak region and to advance the Regional Sustainability Plan, also known as PPR 2030. Pikes Peak Environmental Forum. The Pikes Peak Environmental Forum educates and connects citizens with sustainability efforts throughout El Paso County with monthly presentations and newsletters. Pikes Peak Permaculture provides education and instruction to the general public on the nature, ways, and benefits of the discipline of permaculture. The Chinook Center. The Chinook Center is a progressive, mission-driven community space that empowers and connects people and grassroots organizations working for social, economic, and environmental justice in the Pikes Peak region. And finally, Studio 809 podcast, who is actually recording and going to be turning tonight's event into its next podcast episode. It will be available on Studio 809 podcast's website, that's also in the chat, in about a week. And Studio 809 brings you thoughtful, respectful, and intelligent programs from the Pikes Peak region. One more brief shout out to Students for Environmental Awareness and Sustainability at UCCS, Food to Power, Conscious Living Shop, and Eclectic Colorado. Again, all these organizations are listed in the chat with their website links. If you'd like to read up on any of them or reach out to all of them, they would love to hear from you. Thanks. And I'll turn it back over to Anna.
Thank you so much for that, Lindsay. Thanks again to all the sponsors. It's without a doubt why we have so many folks joining us tonight. I'm looking down at the participants and it looks like we've got about 105 people joining us tonight. So thank you so much for that. All right. So the next thing I'm going to do is pass it over to our main event organizer here. But before that, I want to get y'all ready for all the amazing things we're about to learn and take action on for the climate by inviting you to please open up your email inboxes. As I mentioned, there'll be several opportunities to take action throughout the next hour here, as well as once we go to breakout rooms. And so I want to invite folks to be ready for that by opening up their email inboxes and opening a couple of blank emails so that you can take your actions on the go tonight as we do this little, you know, speed dating for climate action here. So with that, I want to pass it over to my friend, Philip. You know, round of applause here. Philip has spent a lot of time over the last month pulling together this event and has done an amazing job. So Philip, I'll let you take it from here. Thank you.
Thank you so much for the sweet introduction, Anna. And I would be nowhere without all our sponsors and you all. So I would just like to very quickly say I'm a Bonner Fellow and a Sierra Club student campaign organizer and a Colorado College student, and I come originally from Slovakia. I would just like to say, as Anna already said, Martin Drake campaign was huge, but we should move on and think about what is next for Colorado Springs to make this city more sustainable and just. So in this event, you will learn not only about what these next steps and what these campaigns are, but also you can contribute to them on the spot, as Anna just mentioned. So we have managed to put down a big power plant and, for example, 50 emails about parking requirements, about the zoning laws, about which Max is going to talk about, force the city to change their plans. So there is a lot of power that we have. Right now, there is more than 100 people on the call. So we can do a lot if each of us is going to take very fast and effective action. And so without further ado, let's move to the updates about the transition of Martin Drake Power Plant. I would like to introduce to you David Paget, who is the General Manager of Environmental Services at Colorado Springs Utilities. He has been with CSU for 36 years, and the majority of his career he spent in the environmental field. So I'll hand it over to you, Dave.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here this evening with everyone. And as Anna said at the outset, many of you know that our utilities board had announced or had made a decision and approved a portfolio going forward with our integrated resource planning process in June of last year. And as part of that decision-making and approval of that portfolio, Anna had mentioned that our coal-fired units would be closing down by 2030. But for Drake, as some of you may know, that closure is happening much more quickly. And in fact, the decision on Drake was to close it by the end of 2022. And the decision on Nixon was the end of 2029. What's next for Drake? What's the near term for Drake? And what will you see happening at Drake over the next few years? One of the key aspects of closing Drake early, and there's a couple of things that we need to have happen. And one is to have generation at the site until such time as we can build a transmission line from the east side of town to the substation located at the Drake plant. And that substation will continue to stay there. We expect that that transmission project would be complete by the end of 2025. At which time the generation units I'll talk about next would be relocated. So you may have seen in the news last week, maybe some press conferences announcing that Colorado Springs Utilities was partnering with GE, General Electric, to purchase 6 temporary natural gas generators. Each of those is about 30 to 34 megawatts. We would operate those at the Drake Power Plant, probably getting them in early 2022 in preparation to begin operating them as we need to meet that end of 2022 retirement dates for both units 6 and 7. You know, as you know, right now, with large fixed power plants, units 6 and 7 are baseload units. In other words, they would be generating power often to serve demand, and where these units are going to be, you know, very fast start units, run on natural gas, and be designed to meet primarily summer peak loads. But obviously, if we have days like we just experienced this past weekend, when we set a new winter summer peak demand, we would use those then, but certainly not nearly what we run Drake 6 and 7 now. The other thing you may not know, we currently, as of last year, we don't have the capability to run Drake 7 on coal. It only runs on natural gas. In fact, we made a physical disconnection at the plant and made the state aware and declared that it would only be run on natural gas. So as somebody noted in chat, the only unit right now at Drake that's capable of running on coal is unit 6. And as I said, we'll begin to transition away from those units as we install these temporary natural gas generation units. So then what happens beyond that? Once we're able to complete that transmission project to the Drake plant, we won't need transmission at Drake or generation at Drake, I'm sorry. So the plan would be then to relocate those units in more of a distributed fashion. And right now we're still exploring the feasibility of what those locations would be. We're planning on building what we're referring to as an advanced technology campus out on the east part of town near the airport. So there's a thought that some might go there. We've also been working quite a bit with the local military, in particular Fort Carson and Peterson Air Force Base, on their desires to have resiliency for their generation. that's been an important partnership and one that going forward, these generators, and that's sort of one of the values of these generators, they're very mobile, don't have to be all in one place, and likely they won't be all in one place. Between 2022 and 2025, then you would also begin to see the decommissioning work. So as part of the process for decommissioning a power plant, first is to establish retirement dates, which we just talked about, and then the actual decommissioning work done. In other words, the taking apart of the structures, the demolition, the environmental analysis, and that will take place, you know, once we put the temporary natural gas generator units in place up to 2025. Now, beyond that, we can't say with any certainty, I don't know that anyone can, you know, what the future use of that property would be. As I said, the only footprint Colorado Springs Utilities would retain is that key substation that will need to remain there. And if anybody should desire that, that old original plant, that brick part of the plant, might want to retain that for some historical purposes. But beyond that, I think there would be a pretty robust conversation, probably led by City Council Utilities Board, you know, in terms of what the future of that property might look like once we decommission the site. Since we're talking about carbon, I'll also say that our plan is to submit a clean energy plan to the Public Utilities Commission. As some of you know, we're not regulated by the PUC, but we've committed to putting together a clean energy plan as the other utilities in the state have. And the purpose of that is to demonstrate how we can meet the state's climate goals, which call for an 80% reduction by 2030. And that's our commitment with the closure of Drake and also with the closure of the Nixon plant, as I said, at the end of 2029. Some of the other things we're excited about, the additional solar that we've contracted for by 2023. We've opened up a couple of new solar farms in recent years, but we plan to add additional 175 megawatts and a 25 megawatt battery. And as many of you know, that will be the likely technology sort of going forward, hopefully from a renewable standpoint, battery storage, our future plans to grow our renewable portfolio even further. And so these temporary natural gas generators, depending on where we need to redeploy them, will be an important bridge for the reliability of our system as we add more increments of renewable energy.
Thank you so much for that. The transition information is very interesting. And the chat, as we can see, is just booming with questions. So I would like to start with the first one. And Jeremiah is asking if the natural gas is really what we want as a renewable source, but can you just tell us more about how the transition is going to look like, maybe from natural gas to more renewable sources later on?
Well, I understand that natural gas obviously is still a fossil fuel, albeit roughly less than half the carbon, the CO2 emissions from coal. And again, I think the important thing is that our plan would not be to run those units as we would a stationary coal unit, like the Drake units or the Nixon unit down south. They would be run to help meet our peak summer demands. And in those times when renewables either may not be available or we just need to supplement as we grow that portfolio, more of a bridge type generation. So, you know, don't think of adding these in one place and then running them as we would a fixed power plant.
Okay, thank you. And we don't have time for many more questions, but I'd like to ask you one more, which is, what is going to happen to the workers? And is there any transfer of people's jobs to support their families, or how do you account for that change?
I'm really glad you asked that question. In fact, we've had a plan in place that we started last year when that decision was made to begin to transition the employees at the Drake plant into other parts of the organization. And that plan has been started. We made a commitment to our employees that nobody would be laid off, that we would have a place for them in the organization. And the beauty for us being a four-service utility, water, wastewater, gas, and electric, is that we have skill sets for, you know, many of those folks that translate into our other services, whether they're mechanics or heavy equipment operators or project managers. So we're in the midst of that transition plan right now. And so I'm glad you asked that, because that is an important part of our commitment to the employees going forward.
Okay, that's very good to know. So Dave, thank you so much for this information. It is very valuable. And as we can see in the chat, people really care about this transition. I would all encourage you to reach out to Dave. His email is going to be sent around in a document later on during the event as we approach the end. So please reach out, bring those good questions. And so let's move to our next speaker, who is Jenny Wilford. She is a clean energy advocate working with the Colorado Sierra Club. And Jenny focuses on gas-free homes and buildings. And she also loves fly fishing. So I would hand it over to Jenny, and please walk us through what you have here.
Great. Thank you so much, Phillips. And I also want to say a quick thanks to everybody for their work putting this event together. I'm so excited to be included and really love the campaign speed dating experience as well. It's definitely something new for me. What I really want to do is I want to start our conversation off by grounding us in our state climate goals that you just heard Dave reference, as well as talk a little bit about our 2020 greenhouse gas emissions inventory. So some of you may know that in 2019, the Colorado State Legislature passed House Bill 1261, which is the Climate Action Plan to Reduce Pollution. Now, this bill created a framework to tackle climate change by setting science-based goals to reduce carbon pollution, which, as you all know, is the underlying cause of climate change. Now, as far as those greenhouse gas emission reduction goals, they do call for 26% reductions by 2025, which is just around the corner, 50% reductions by 2030, and a full 90% reduction of greenhouse gas emissions by 2050 compared to 2005 levels. And what you see on this slide here is a quick snapshot of Colorado's greenhouse gas emissions inventory that was produced last year. And what you will be able to see, I'm just trying to look for the colors here, is that I believe in orange there, what this shows is essentially where all of our sources of pollution in the state come from. And so in order, the highest level of emissions come from the transportation sector, which is there in red, followed by electricity generation in orange there. So think, you know, coal, producing natural gas. And then the third highest source of pollution there in navy blue is oil and gas. So oil and gas extraction production. And then right over here in kind of this lighter color blue are the pollution that comes directly from buildings. And what's really interesting here is that pollution in buildings in many ways is kind of connected to the emissions from the electricity generation sector, as well as the emissions directly from the oil and gas sector, especially when you're thinking about extraction and methane leakage. While there's been a lot of work to clean up the electricity generation sector, lots of coal plants slated all the way through 2030, there's also been work in terms of rulemakings as well as legislation, clean up the oil and gas, as well as the transportation sectors. The one area that there just has not been action on that I really think is kind of next on the horizon for climate action is the environment. So from here on out, you're not going to hear me call gas natural gas. And that is super intentional because gases are risky, dangerous, and polluting fossil fuels. So we're going to call it that. To be completely blunt, when we're thinking about what the problem is with using gas, the problem is that using gas inside of our homes and buildings pollutes our air, our indoor air. It's harmful to our health, and it releases emissions into the atmosphere, which absolutely drives climate change. Some of the gas appliances that you may have in your home include the furnace, gas stove. Sometimes folks even have gas-powered clothes dryers as well. But I want to hone in on gas stoves for just a minute here. Gas stoves in particular are dangerous beyond just heating the planet. They also cause very serious health problems. Gas stoves emit a host of dangerous pollutants, including particulate matter, formaldehyde, carbon monoxide, and nitrogen dioxide. Now, carbon monoxide poisoning, most folks know that that's a killer, right? And many folks do have carbon monoxide detectors in their homes to give them a heads up when, you know, the levels inside of their homes are dangerous. But new research is telling a very different story in that the standard sensor doesn't always pick up potentially dangerous carbon monoxide emissions. Then we, you know, as we move on down the line, there's not nitrogen dioxide, which is not regulated indoors or has been linked to an increased risk of heart attacks, asthma, and other respiratory diseases. There was a report released last summer that was commissioned by the Sierra Club, Physicians for Social Responsibility, and Mothers Out Front that found that homes with gas stoves have anywhere between 50 and 400% higher concentrations of nitrogen dioxide than homes without a gas stove. And they also observed that when running a gas stove for just 45 minutes, that created levels of pollution that would be illegal if measured indoors. What's also really concerning is that children are more vulnerable to air pollution due to several factors, including their developing lungs and smaller body size. Children living in a home with a gas stove have a 42% increased risk of developing asthma. And lower income populations and communities of color are also disproportionately impacted with risk factors that include increased exposure to a number of those pollutants that I shared earlier due to smaller and older homes and less efficient gas appliances. Oftentimes, folks will use their gas stove for heating as well, which is another risk. Despite the climate and health risk, Colorado continues to build tens of thousands of new gas homes and buildings every year, which locks us into decades of unnecessary climate destruction, air pollution, and health risks for our communities. So connecting new homes and buildings to the gas system requires investing money into expanding and maintaining gas pipelines. And that's an unnecessary and costly financial investment that will need to be paid back by all ratepayers over decades. Furthermore, hooking up a new single-family home to the gas system adds between $5,000 and $8,000 in unnecessary building costs. So what this slide shows, this is a slide from some assumptions that Colorado Springs Utilities made in 2015. And typically when utilities are conducting their resource planning process, they try to anticipate customer demand and usage. And so the graphics that you're seeing here on this slide show that they're making the assumption that as the area grows, that all new buildings will be connected to gas, which means that the demand for gas is going to keep going up, which means that there will be a sustained need for oil and gas extraction, which is definitely incompatible with our climate goals. And so the best answer to push back on that is to get gas out of homes and buildings. And I will say that outdated policy hurdles that favor gas, powerful special interests, and then a general lack of public awareness of the dangers of gas have kept Coloradans locked into the gas system for a very long time. And if Colorado is going to achieve our air quality and climate goals, we have to shift off of gas. And that starts by electrifying homes, schools, and businesses right now. High-performing and super-efficient electric appliances are available right now to replace all gas appliances. And today's heat pump and HVAC equipment is not only highly efficient, but it works really well in cold climates and can be used in urban as well as rural areas. So one example that I'll just briefly share with you all comes from Pitkin County. So Pitkin County, the Roaring Fork School District, and Habitat for Humanity were just observing that with the extraordinary high cost of housing, that the community was having a tough time attracting and retaining teachers and other county employees. So they banded together through a local partnership. The school district donated some land behind the high school. The county provided some funding for planning and infrastructure, and Habitat for Humanity provided volunteers and building power. And together, they are building 27 new all-electric, highly energy-efficient, net-zero affordable housing units for teachers and county employees. And the really cool thing is that they are using absolutely no gas in this community. So there's not a gas line, no hookups whatsoever. And part of the reason I share this example is because Basalt Vista, which is the name of this development, is the first all-electric net zero community in Colorado. And not only is it in Colorado, but it's in a very cold area of our state, and it's definitely in a rural area, which goes a long way in proving that we have the technology we need right now to make the transition to gas-free homes. So when we think about what action could look like on gas-free buildings in 2021, there is obviously work that can happen at the state legislature. And I will share that we are expecting to see legislation that could ask investor-owned utilities to develop plans to replace gas, oil, as well as propane-powered appliances with electric versions, and to really be a partner with communities in realizing a gas-free future. The one thing that I will share here, though, is that with the legislation aimed at investor-owned utilities, that means that municipal utilities like Colorado Springs aren't included in that legislation. So I think that's one important distinction. And basically, what that tells us is that in order for Colorado Springs to move towards a gas-free future, that requires local action, which brings me to the next bullet here on my slide. We are expecting to see, and actually have already seen, a bill introduced at the legislature that would preempt local governments from being able to pass any sort of regulations on gas in their communities, which means that we know Colorado Springs utility can't be regulated by the Public Utilities Commission, so we need local action. This bill would take away that ability for Colorado Springs to act. So we want to make sure that that bill is defeated. And one of the actions that I'll be speaking to in just a moment will help to do that. But really, the local action here is that we need the city council to basically identify a gas-free future as part of their priorities. There are more than 42 municipalities across the United States that have taken action to move their communities towards a gas-free future. And a lot of the work that they've done has been achieved by strengthening building codes that are able to discourage expanding gas hookups and new construction. And a lot of that work is getting started here in Colorado. The city and county of Denver is already on track to require all new buildings to be electric by 2027. And they're currently working through a plan of figuring out how they retrofit, right? So get gas out of existing buildings by 2040. So I guess before we jump into the action, I'll just say that the science is clear. We can't reduce greenhouse gas emissions to the level required by climate science or 1261 goals if we continue to burn gas in our homes and buildings. So what I'm asking for you to do this evening is to open up your email, and I'm going to drop this first link here that you're seeing into the chat. And what I want you to do is I want you to go and figure out who your state legislator is. And then the other thing I want you to do is go and find out who your city council member is. And both of these links that I am going to drop into the chat will enable you to do that. So the first one is for your city council member, and the second one that's coming here is for your legislator. And I want you to send each of them an email. And I want you to basically say to them that you are one of their constituents and that you're worried about the climate and indoor air pollution that comes from gas appliances in our homes. And what you're asking is to see action to reduce the pollution. And you're asking them to also stand up for gas-free buildings in Colorado Springs and across Colorado. So with that, I'm going to pause. Philip, is this the time that folks are able to go ahead and send their emails, or do you want to take questions and move along?
So because we are a little bit behind time, first of all, no, Jenny, thank you so much for bringing all this on the table. And I think it's so interesting. I would have no clue about all the health effects as well. So that is really motivating. And I hope all of you feel very motivated to actually send this email. But we have to move on to our next speaker because we are a little bit behind on time. But if you have any questions, please reach out to Jenny. Then soon there'll be a link in the chat from Justin, who is sharing the Action Toolkit document with a sample email and all the information to complete this task. So you can work on it whenever you would like. And if you finish it by tonight, you will be included in the raffle. So that being said, Jenny, thank you so much again. And sorry again to cut this off, but we need to move on to our next speaker because the agenda is pretty full. And in that case, we are moving. So this you can find in the document that Justin just sent. And we'll be moving to our recent CEC graduate, Max Kornstedt, who is a co-founder and an organizer of the Colorado Springs Pro Housing Partnership. He will be speaking on how zoning changes can make more affordable housing in Colorado Springs and reduce our carbon footprint. So Max, I'm going to hand it over to you. Just let me know when to skip the slides. I hope this time I'll do a better job.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Philip, and to everyone who helped make this possible and help shut down the Martin Drake coal plant and keep the flame alive. I really appreciate it. Philip, you can go to the next slide. So my name is Max Kronstadt. I'm a co-founder and co-organizer of the Colorado Springs Pro Housing Partnership, and we are a grassroots coalition focused on organizing our neighbors to speak out in support of city policies that will make housing more affordable. And so we have been focused for the last 2 years or so on zoning changes. And I sort of wanted to say at the beginning to acknowledge that zoning is often boring. You know, when we think of zoning, we often think of a long city council meeting that, doesn't end and seems pointless. But I hope to convince you through this that zoning, changing our zoning laws is not only critical to addressing our affordable housing crisis, but also to addressing our climate crisis. So Philip, you can keep it going. So what is zoning? They're essentially a series of laws that dictate what can be built where in a city. So they separate our residential areas from our industrial areas, from our commercial areas, from our office areas, from our parks, all of those different things. And it ends up looking like this sort of piecemeal thing that you see on the map. I mean, it also within residential areas determines what kinds of housing can be allowed where. So zoning is important because it is largely responsible, among other things, for creating the built environment in the city that we see today and that you see pictured on your screen, right? One of single family neighborhoods throughout most of the city, large parking lots in front of large strip malls and large outlet malls, and the few apartments that are available downtown, really expensive. So I tried to sort of pick some pictures that would really illustrate what zoning is doing to our city and our built environment. And so right now, the reason for that, or the primary reason for that, is that upwards of 83% of Colorado Springs residential land is zoned for single family use. What that means is you can only build one relatively large home on a large piece of land. And so this does a couple of things. It drives up the cost of housing by banning smaller, more affordable kinds of housing like townhomes, duplexes, small apartment buildings. And it also reduces the overall supply of housing. So as our city is growing, which it's growing very rapidly, single family zoning ensures that our supply isn't going to keep pace with our demand, and that's going to cause prices to rise. But we're here today to talk about the effect that single family zoning is having on the environment. And so zoning is driving a huge amount of our transportation emissions, which Jenny identified is the largest sector of emissions in Colorado, and also our home energy use, which I'll get into. So Colorado Springs in 1947 was 7 square miles. Right now, it's just about under 200 square miles. And so the reason for that is that as our city grew over the last 70 years, the vast majority of our neighborhoods became zoned for single family. So then all new development had to go further out and out and out. And that's why we continue to see development out east in Banning Lewis Ranch and up north. And so urban sprawl means that we have more cars driving longer distances to get where they're going. So that means more people on the road and more emissions. It also eats up our open space, which we know can be important carbon sinks and also important ways for us to enjoy our natural environment. And it frustrates our ability to develop a robust public transportation system, which would further reduce the amount of cars that we have on the road and further reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. And that's because when people live really far apart, there just aren't the riders per route that make it economically feasible to have a transportation system. So we need to allow more kinds of housing in the existing parts of the city so that we can develop that transportation system and further reduce our greenhouse gas emissions. The way our zoning code is set up also frustrates our ability to have walkable, bikeable neighborhoods. So like neighborhood storefronts, office buildings, a lot of those things aren't legal in our residential areas. And so what that means is if someone wants to go shopping, if they want to go to work, they have to get in their car. through zoning changes, what we'd like to do is see more businesses allowed everywhere throughout the city so that someone can just walk down the street to go get a coffee or go to the grocery store or do whatever they need to do. And that way we'll have more people walking and biking, fewer cars on the road. And this kind of goes without saying, I think, but, you know, larger homes use more energy to heat and cool. And so if we continue to use single family zoning as the predominant form of residential use, then we're going to end up using a lot of energy in our homes. So fortunately, the city is currently undergoing a comprehensive revision of the zoning code. This is something they only do every 25 to 30 years. So this is a major, major opportunity to make a real difference on our zoning laws and help deal with our affordable housing crisis and our climate crisis. So they divided up into three sections, two of which have passed already. The third is coming. And the city council, it's been mostly city staff working on it for now, but city council will hear it this summer. So that's a really important, this summer is going to be a really important time for us to advocate for our city council that they allow more kinds of housing throughout the city. But the city will accept comments at any time. And we think that the more comments they hear from people like us who want to see more kinds of housing allowed in more parts of the city to have robust public transit, affordable homes, and open space abounding, better off we'll be when it comes to city council time. So I know this is like kind of small. And so I don't know, Philip, if you want to wait on the action or how you want to do this.
Yeah, you can just go ahead and explain what is expected and we can spend a few minutes for people to actually doing this. And maybe okay. Now, as Max is going to explain, you can already pull up your emails, and just get ready as he's talking to you what to do so that you can be working on it already. And we'll have a few minutes to work on that. And if people have any questions, they can reach out to you via chat. And then we need to move on a bit earlier again.
All the emails go to retoolcos@coloradosprings.gov. That's where they house all of the comments. And then if you feel so inclined, we would love it if you would CC your city council members as well. Put their emails here. And then our email, csprings.php@gmail.com, we ask that you BCC us just so we can keep track of the comments. So we would love for you to first just acknowledge that there isn't a comment period right now, but you recently learned about Retool COS and you wanted to, you know, submit a comment and explain that you want more permitted uses in existing single family zones. That's the most important thing. I mean, that's essentially zoning speak for allowing more kinds of housing and neighborhood storefronts throughout the city. Higher density in our flex zones, that's a reflection of the new kind of zoning that they've created, is generally good, but they're not allowing enough housing in the zones that they've proposed. You can sort of pick whichever of the reasons for this that are most appealing to you, whether it's the affordability of housing, the reduction in urban sprawl and vehicle emissions, walkability and bikeability in all of our neighborhoods, or the development of a robust public transit system, or really anything else you want to come up with for why that's important. And you know, just one sentence about that is fine. I didn't get into this too much, just for time reasons, but parking requirements, minimum parking requirements have a similar effect on housing affordability and on urban sprawl and our environment by forcing us to use more land and dedicated to cars rather than people. That's all I've got. And thank you all for taking the time to come. And we'll hope to see your comments in our email inbox.
Thank you so much. Very quickly, just to tell you for taking the time and explaining to us how this works. So we see in the chat that the link isn't working. So I'm going to send you the proper link right now. And Max, in the meanwhile, please, could you tell us a little bit more about how the 50 emails were so powerful? I don't want to put you on the spot, but like, I just like to use that as an example of how advocacy can be a powerful thing. Just a few words, if you can.
Yeah, sure. So the first module, they call of Retool COS, dealt with the actual zone districts. And so we got about 50 people to comment and say they wanted to see more permitted uses in single family zones. And, you know, it definitely hasn't won us the battle yet, but it definitely made the city reconsider the way that they're approaching things. You know, the standard line is we're not going to touch existing single family zones. And the more that we say, you know, actually, lots of people in this city want to see us touch existing single family zones. It's not just, you know, these more established homeowners. Those aren't the only people who live in our city. The more that we are to make these kind of changes that we need to see.
That's great. Thank you so much for saving us here as we are figuring out stuff. And also for just sharing this information. So all of you, I just shared the link. If you have any questions to Max or anybody else on this panel, please reach out to them. And if you fill in two out of these three action items tonight, you'll be included in the raffle. I'm not sure. I know you're not here for the raffle, but just want to motivate you. It's a very good one to the three building coffee. So I hope you manage to do something. If you have started writing the email, please write an exclamation mark in the chat so that people feel motivated that they have part of something here, even though we are online. Thank you so much. Oh my goodness, so many people. That's great. Please keep that work. And we need to move on to our next speakers, who are Kevin and Chandra from the Peer organization. So Chandra is the Rocky Mountain Office Director with Peer, and she's also an attorney that works with public employees and the whistleblowers. Her focus is on public lands and climate. Kevin is a staff counsel at Peer, and he manages Peer's FOIA requests and litigation and some environmental and whistleblower defense cases. And he also has a very cute dog, which I forgot to include in this presentation. But I think, yeah, from now on, I'll just leave it to the two of you, and please take over and tell us what you have here for us.
So my name is Chandra Rosenthal, and I want to thank Philip for all of his work on this program and for inviting Peer to be part of it. Sierra Club does fantastic work across the state. We've worked with them on air and toxics issues. And I'm also a fan of Colorado College. I want to shout out to all the students participating. You're doing important work by spending your time working on climate issues. I'm going to tell you a little bit about Peer. We're a unique group. We're a conservation group and a good governance group. We work with local and federal employees. They remain anonymous and they bring issues to us. These are whistleblowers. They work from within the government to shine the light on illegal government actions. And then we all work together to improve law and policy. 25% of U.S. fossil fuel production comes from land and water managed directly by the federal government. So a quarter of all U.S. greenhouse gases are from federal public lands. Public lands can offset some greenhouse gas emissions. For example, untouched native soils can be a carbon sink. So what can we do locally to address climate change? The single most cost-effective way to mitigate climate change is to protect land and water habitats. This also conserves open space and protects biodiversity. So who is the other BLM? It's unaffectionately known as the Bureau of Livestock and Mining. Cattle, mines, oil fields are traditional uses here. The energy dominance agenda on these lands has been shameless under the Trump administration. 26 million acres, that's the size of Massachusetts and New Hampshire combined. And although the Biden administration is freezing new leasing, drilling has not stopped. Oil companies have the ability to produce for years. In Colorado, BLM has leased 2.5 million acres to oil and gas companies. This office is all BLM lands around Montrose, Gunnison, Crested Butte, the Black Canyon. Last year, BLM decided to expand oil and gas leasing, mining, and grazing in this area. Local communities were devastated. The governor's office objected. Peer heard from employees in the agency, and we filed a Freedom of Information Act request. We were able to get proof that the local field office was taken out of the decision-making and that Washington, D.C. ignored the science. Headquarters expanded oil development. They increased acreage for mining. They increased acreage for grazing. Now, this information is being used as evidence to sue BLM. The Attorney General of Colorado has declared the planning document illegal. This is Kevin on his mountain bike on BLM Royal Gorge public lands about 12 miles from Colorado Springs. This region has some of the most used areas for river rafting. This office is about 150 miles from Colorado Springs.
This is me in a field, by the way.
Yeah, just past the Great Sand Dunes. The San Luis Valley is a watershed for the Rio Grande River. To address climate change, we have to protect land and water habitats, and we have to work to conserve open space and biodiversity. So this is Knickers, an Australian cow. You never know what you might find on your public lands. So our call for action is to get involved on your public lands. Find out what is happening. The information isn't always easy to get, but sometimes just one person letting the agency know that they are watching a grazing lease or a drilling lease can make all the difference. And now Kevin's going to talk about how to get that information.
Yeah. So as Philip mentioned, I run our Freedom of Information Act or FOIA docket. FOIA is in the United States Code in the same section that has the Administrative Procedure Act and basically all of the other fun bits of how the government governs itself in Title V. So what is the Freedom of Information Act? It's not freedom to any information. It's freedom to documents. So the government, whenever they receive a request for materials, are under an obligation to provide that information if they have it. So they don't have a duty to make new records, but they do have a duty to search for those records. So if you request, say, all materials that concern environmental reviews regarding lease sales that took place in certain field office in a certain period of time, they have to give those to you. You know, they might try to charge you money for it. They might try to give you way more information that you want or bury you in documents. But ultimately, they do have a legal duty to do so. And when they don't do it, I sue them. That's kind of my bread and butter day to day. You know, whenever you're making a FOIA request, which is ultimately what we're going to be asking and hopefully teaching you a little bit about how to do, you need to make sure that you are adequately describing not only the request that you want to get the documents that you want, but to not include a whole bunch of stuff that you do not want. So you hopefully would describe the records that you want, the custodians, and the time frame that you're searching in. And we have a big list of like 40 different example ones that we can sort of assign out to people as they're interested in. So you don't have to worry about getting too creative on your own. And we're also not asking you to necessarily do this one tonight, because it also might require some thought if you want to think about how to do a FOIA request and what for. So they have a duty to respond in 20 working days. They will not respond in 20 working days. I can absolutely guarantee it, because their failure to respond is how we drive a lot of our litigation. So FOIA requests. As I mentioned earlier, FOIA requests are made whenever there is a record that you either know or reasonably believe to exist and you want to make a request for it. So, you know, there's all sorts of different things that could fall into that. And what matters is basically both what you're looking for and also who you're asking. So this is how you ask. It's FOIAonline.gov. The various bureaus of the Department of the Interior have recently joined the Environmental Protection Agency, the Department of the Navy, the Department of Commerce, and a smorgasbord of other various agencies in using this as their main and sole portal for making FOIA requests. So let me tell you a little bit about it. So FOIA Online has a couple different drop-down menus here. It has what agency you want to send a request to. So in this case, you would select the Department of the Interior, under which the Bureau of Land Management is housed. That's one of its several component bureaus. Within that, it would be the Bureau of Land Management, and within that, BLM Colorado, because it goes all the way down to field office, or rather all the way down to state office. And then the field offices, as Chandra mentioned earlier, such as Uncompahgre in her example slide, those weren't actually pictures of me, by the way. I don't look that good on a bike. It would allow you to basically put that together. So the screen that you're seeing right here is one that was made without actually making an account or logging into anything. You can just submit a request if you want to. You just need to give an email address and various demographics and the text of the request itself. So, you know, what exactly goes into a request? So in a request, I like to include a brief introduction to basically what exactly it is, the thing that we're looking for, then the records that we want, who has them, and then finally what's called a fee waiver request. So I mentioned earlier that the government might try and charge you a bunch of money for a request. This is a very mean thing that they do, and it's primarily used when companies want to request a whole bunch of confidential business information that one of their rivals may or may not have submitted to, you know, this various government oversight agencies. Fees are almost never actually paid by people. Like 98% of cases don't actually have any fees that are paid, but they're often used to deter individual citizens who are attempting to do their own citizen oversight, as opposed to large and litigious groups like our own. So how do you avoid those? With what's called a fee waiver request. So whenever you're filling out the document, you would go in and you would check a little box that says, I would like fees to be waived on this purpose. You can see that there's a lot of text there, which you probably can't read. I'm looking right at it. And like, I wrote this document. I have no idea what it says. So we could provide you with some examples. But basically, you need to show either A, you are a member of an educational organization or a scientific organization. So a student at a university, college professor, somebody who has even the loosest affiliation with something. You know, basically, if you have a .edu email address, you can usually meet that one. Or alternately, you can show that you are an other use requester, which is what peer is typically considered to be. So you just have to show that you have no commercial interest in the data. So if you're not a business, that's an easy one. That it concerns the operations or activities of the government, which is almost intrinsic. That's, again, just to deter people from seeking business records from their rivals and the whatever business they do. That it's likely to contribute to public understanding of an issue, and that that contribution to public understanding will be significant. So if you could do that in a narrative form, you know, say a couple sentences, typically, again, it's pretty easy. Most FOIA officers will assume that you will probably meet the requirements for a fee waiver request if you actually make that request. It just sort of varies a little bit agency by agency. So let's talk about what you actually get after you make that request. So whenever you make a request, obviously they're going to redact stuff. Everybody's familiar with the vicious black boxes that you end up seeing either in meme forms or in a lot of regular popular television or whenever somebody does a documentary about an intelligence agency. So there are a couple specific things that they can redact information on. And this slideshow is adapted from one that I do for my interns in my office every summer. So forgive me if it's a little bit pedantic, but within Section 552, which is the Freedom of Information Act, there are 8 different exceptions for what it is they can withhold. The one that you're most likely to run into is Exemption 5, specifically the deliberative process privilege, which allows them to withhold anything related to the making of a decision before they actually make that decision. So, you know, that's basically it in terms of like the nuts and bolts of how a FOIA request, the fee waiver that you would want to make inside it, and what the withholdings would be are. So sort of gives you some points on like how it is to learn more about FOIA. So anybody who is watching this right now has the freedom to submit a Freedom of Information Act request. It's a, you know, fun and relatively easy way to make life slightly more difficult for people who are in government offices, and also to see the records that are held by government agencies about what it is that is going on with the public lands that we all inhabit, be that, you know, how it is that fossil fuels are contributing to climate change, how it is that agencies have actually considered climate impacts of the decisions that they make to approve things like lease sales or drilling permits or mining operations or things like that, or whether or not they've actually considered the climate impacts of increased grazing on livestock or the impacts to, say, native plants and soils. So we've put together a list of, I believe it was 41 when I last checked in the Google Doc, possible different things that you can yourself do or go and request. But because, again, this is a slightly more complex one and not the sort of thing you can accomplish with just an email message, I did want to sort of leave it open to sort of do a little bit of question and answer and like how exactly to do this. What does this information matter? What should I actually be looking for here? You know, it's my goal to make the people who are here today better at their own citizen oversight and getting information and records from government agencies so that they can then, you know, both inform the government agency that they have their eye on them and somebody's paying attention to whatever the thing is that they're doing, but also so that you can then take those records and turn around and give them to journalists or environmental groups like the several who sponsored the group today. Like us or the Sierra Club. I know the Sierra Club's FOIA lawyer very well. She's very nice. Basically, use the powers that are guaranteed you by the statutes of the United States. So that's basically my spiel. It's very technical. Sorry, it wasn't very environmental.
No worries at all. Thank you so much, both of you, for sharing this. And this seems like a powerful tool to protect our public lands. And we have a few more minutes if you want to share a bit more, if you think that is useful, or do you think it's better if people come to you in a breakout room session where they can ask you for more information?
So, you know, one quick thing that I just saw in the chat over here, I saw that, can you offer an example of a request? So again, the things that I had in there earlier are examples of requests. You don't need to make it as detailed as the ones that we often submit, because we're usually submitting them with the anticipation of possible litigation down the line. But a request could just be, I would like all emails sent by the field manager for the Uncompahgre field office of the Bureau of Land Management between December 31st, 2017 and December 31st of 2018. So you just get all of one dude's emails for a year. I mean, they'd probably be heavily redacted and they would probably fight you on a fee waiver, because I don't really see, like, you know, unless you have a very specific reason for wanting that guy's emails in particular, then it would be difficult to justify. But that is an example of a request.
Okay.
I also saw, was it Pure or a different organization that sued the BLM? We've sued the BLM several times, but we're not alone in that.
And there's one more from Jessica.
Oh, yes. Do you have any tips for what to look for in the documents once we have them? So there are a couple things that you want to look for. The first and the biggest one is one of the things that I included in our list is things like public comments on environmental documentation that goes out, as well as letters of requesting consultation from, and then like the actual comments that are received from, tribal nations. So there's a federal policy that says that before you can approve oil and gas leasing, you have to consult with impacted tribals, you know, tribal governments. And so the leaders of those tribal governments are allowed to submit comments back. However, the Bureau of Land Management does not, as a default, keep those things public. So you and I cannot just go to a BLM website and see them. We have to actually ask for them in advance. So that's one of the things that we have included in our list of examples. Same thing with comments on proposed actions taken pursuant to the National Environmental Policy Act, or NEPA. So these are comments similar to the ones that you would have submitted in one of the prior action items that are received by a government agency, but that government agency does not tell everybody else and the members of the public that they got those comments. So like, we have no way of knowing what other people are doing to influence the policies that are being undertaken by those government agencies unless we go and ask them first. So things that you can do with that are, go get the information and then publish it yourself. I don't know, put it on Twitter. You can take that and provide it to, again, another oversight organization, like one of the ones that are involved in this project. Anything like that. You can print it all out, put it in a fire, burn it symbolically. I mean, don't do that. That's carbon emissions, but still.
Okay, we'll stop you here, Kevin, before it gets violent.
Okay. Inevitable.
Okay, thank you so much, both of you. And before we move on to the breakout rooms, and where you can learn so much more about FOIA requests from Chandra and Kevin, or from about gas-free buildings from Jenny, or zoning in Colorado Springs from Max. Or if you want to just hang out, you can pop in as well. Before we do that, though, I would like to just stress, I don't want to make this about money or anything like that, but just like how a cool thing to have a nice voucher to a coffee shop local that is local. So if you do complete 2 out of the 3 actions that we are asking you to do by tonight and fill out a survey that we are going to send in now by tonight as well, you will be included in this raffle to win the gift card. And the survey, just in a few words, we are just trying to, a part of advocacy is to find out what people care about, and we just want to know what you care about and how you would like to get involved in Colorado Springs. Now, here you've got 3 examples, and if you want to get involved more and get engaged more in with these issues, you can now jump into the breakout room sessions, just in a second before we thank everybody. Just jump, choose which one you're interested in. If you have any more questions, if you just want to hang out with somebody, please feel free to do that. And you do it by going down to the Zoom toolbar, and then on the right side, you see the breakout rooms icon, and then you just jump in there. And so lastly, we would just like to thank you all for being here. Thank you so much, our speakers. You have done a wonderful job. I would be left to give these a virtual clap. And thank you to our sponsors again. There was a great, 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 I mean, reach out that we have done to all of you. And thank you to all of you for just coming in and being incredibly engaged and for filling up all these requests, which are not many, I know it was a lot of information, but it is a very valuable information that we can change a lot, only all of us here. So with all of that, I'll leave it up to you. Please feel free to reach out. We will follow up with everybody else who RSVP'd online later on with all the documents you need and any other information and the recordings. So we see a lot of things in the chat. Is there anything else before we move on to the breakout room, or go our day?
You did a great job, Philip. Thank you so much. And once again, everyone will be receiving a copy of a Google document with all the action items via email. So you can certainly look at that, forward it on to other people who you think might be interested in also helping taking action. And that was awesome. Way to go.
Cool. With that, we'll leave you to go decide if you want to go to breakout rooms or do your own thing. But it was great to see you all tonight. And take care. And good luck with the advocacy.
Thanks for listening. Check the show notes for links. The Peak Environment podcast is part of the Studio 809 Podcasts Collective, voices from the Pikes Peak region. Check out all the podcasts at studio809podcasts.com.
Hi, this is Dave Gardner. I just want to make sure you know that during these unusual times, peakradar.com/virtual brings local arts and entertainment right into your home. From local music to gallery tours to classes in dance, yoga, writing, and more, our community is still creative and invites you to join in at peakradar.com/virtual.